From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with Amitabh Ghosh about religious fundamentalism in Egypt and in India. Ghosh is a writer of Hindu descent who lives in Calcutta and spent part of the 80s in small Egyptian villages. In the Crown Heights section of Brooklyn, there's racial tension between ultra-Orthodox Jews and African-Americans. Anna Deavere Smith's one-person show about this will be broadcast Wednesday evening on PBS. We'll feature a performance excerpt and interview. Also, reviews of a new novel by Czech writer Ivan Klima and a new video of Handel's Julius Caesar, directed by Peter Sellers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House said today that the vote of confidence given to Boris Yeltsin was a solid victory and continued to push for additional economic assistance to help him achieve democratic reforms in Russia. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
President Clinton called the vote a tribute to Boris Yeltsin's courage and to the farsightedness of the Russian people. He said he congratulated Yeltsin by telephone today and said that in response, the Russian leader offered him a great Russian bear hug in return for his continued support for democratic reforms in the former Soviet Republic. The president said the referendum results may help smooth the way for passage of Russian aid through the United States Congress.
I do believe that that we have to think of this as a long-term effort. We have to be in this for the long run. But I think it will be immensely beneficial to the United States.
The president extended $1.6 billion in assistance at his summit with Yeltsin in Vancouver and more recently pledged $1.8 billion more in grants and loans to help speed market reforms. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
The economic embargo against Serbia and Montenegro is being extended and tightened in an effort to punish the Serbian government for its support of the ethnic Serbs in Bosnia. The self-proclaimed Bosnian Serb parliament met in emergency session last night at the urging of Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic. Despite what was said to be strong pressure from Milosevic, the Bosnian Serbs refused to accept an internationally sponsored peace plan. President Clinton signed an executive order today that would tighten American sanctions against the Serbs, and additional UN sanctions are set to go into effect at midnight tonight. Ohio prison officials are insisting there was no way they could have predicted or prevented the 11-day-long inmate takeover at the state's maximum security prison at Lucasville. That siege ended Wednesday night with more than 400 inmates surrendering and releasing five guards they'd been holding hostage. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
For days, there have been news reports. Prison officials should have been able to realize an inmate rebellion was brewing. Inmates had been storing water and hoarding snacks in anticipation of the Easter Sunday riot and takeover. But Warden Art Tate says he didn't learn of the stockpiling until after the siege began.
Believe me, I've been in this business a long time, and I'm a prudent manager. I feel that I'm a prudent manager. And had I had any indication that we were going to have a serious incident, I would have made some contingencies.
Some reports indicate inmates themselves had warned guards of the upcoming insurrection, but Warden Tate says that kind of talk is always going on. Six different investigations have been launched into the siege, which left nine inmates and one guard dead. For National Public Radio, this is Bill Cohen in Columbus.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 15 points today. This is NPR. Costa Rican officials say that gunmen broke into the country's Supreme Court building and are holding 19 justices hostage. A Supreme Court spokesman said the justices are being held by a group calling itself the Death Commandos. Police have surrounded the building and evacuated some of those inside. There was no immediate indication of the group's demands. During a visit to Germany, Czech President Václav Havel said today the Czech Republic is prepared to assist with international military and humanitarian efforts in Bosnia. Lynn Weil reports.
Havel spent the day in Bonn meeting with Chancellor Helmut Kohl, Foreign Minister Klaus Kinkel, and other top government officials of Germany, which has only recently expanded its own role in the Bosnian conflict. Among other issues, the leaders of the two countries discussed long-term plans for greater Czech involvement in international bodies such as the European Community and NATO. Havel said at a news conference at the end of the day that in light of the rejection of the UN peace proposal for Bosnia, the Czech Republic is prepared to assist in enforcing international sanctions by lending technical support and personnel to international military operations in the region. The Czech Republic, he said, is ready to join other nations in donating food and medicine for the multinational humanitarian mission to Bosnia, which is headquartered at an air base in Germany. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Weil in Bonn.
Emergency officials now say that 63 people survived the crash of an Indian Airlines jet today in western India. 55 people were killed. The Boeing 737 was taking off when it struck a parked truck on the runway. Officials said the plane managed to stay airborne for about 4 miles, but finally lost altitude and struck a high-voltage electrical line. The plane broke into several pieces. Officials said 12 of the survivors were hospitalized, but most walked away with only minor injuries. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ethnic and religious fighting are dividing countries around the world. My guest Amitav Ghosh is a world traveler who now finds religious fighting at home in his country, India. There, Hindu fundamentalists have been attacking Muslims and mosques. These Hindus would like to see India have a religious government. Ghosh is of Hindu descent, but describes himself as an agnostic. He was born in Calcutta in 1956 and studied in New Delhi, Oxford, and Alexandria. He was trained as a cultural anthropologist. In 1980, as part of his research, he lived in two Egyptian villages, 2 hours from Alexandria. His new book, In an Antique Land, is about his time in Egypt. He returned to these villages in 1988 and found dramatic changes. Some of them reflected the growing influence of Islamic fundamentalism, but most of the changes were tied to the economy.
The main thing that changed is, after I left, the Iran-Iraq war started, what you might call the first Gulf War, and that led to a huge migration of migrant workers from Egypt to Iraq. In fact, when I went back in 1988, all the young people I knew were away in Iraq, working in Iraq.
They were taking the jobs of men who were fighting in the Iran-Iraq war.
Exactly, yes. They were working on, the Iraqis who were on the front. Exactly. And this had completely revolutionized the village because they sent back these huge sums of money. And, when I went back in 1988, the standards of living in the village were really revolutionized. The poorest families had washing machines and refrigerators, and everybody was building a new house. And it was extraordinary. It was really like, I really cannot believe that any place could change so much in 8 years.
And you think that was mostly because of the money that was sent back from the younger men who had left for jobs in other countries?
It was entirely that.
Mm-hmm.
It was entirely that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how was the village changed by fundamentalism?
That was a much more sort of gradual process, I remember noticing that even when I was, when I was first in the village, that the people who were most sort of religiously oriented were invariably the school children who were about 13, between 13 and 18. They were very religiously motivated. And as they got older, they got, they became more and more influential in the village. And when I went back in 1988, there was... it wasn't anything very dramatic, but there was certainly a sense that, people were much more sort of religiously motivated than they had been in the past. So even in the past, in this village, for example, people took I'm really now talking about ordinary peasants. They took a very keen interest in developments in Afghanistan, for example. They would contribute the money towards the cause of the Afghan rebels. And that meant a lot to them, for very poor peasants to contribute a few piastres. It does mean a lot.
You had a friend who had grown a beard, and his parents requested that he shave it because they said it was no longer safe to look like a Muslim, even though it was a Muslim country.
I was very struck by that, actually, because, he didn't belong to any organization, and I don't think that he was a part of, of any kind of fundamentalist organization as such. But yes, he did. When he went to college, he went away to college in a town in the Delta, and he, got involved in, he just became sort of more interested in religion, and he grew a beard and so on and so forth. But when he got back to the village, his mother was very worried and said his whole family was very worried and said, "No, you're going to get into trouble with the government, so you'd better shave your beard off." And in the end, they made him shave his beard off. And I think it's, it's quite a telling thing, really, because it is unfortunately the case, I think, often that, there's a very fine line between, the maintenance of peace, of law and order, and repression. And I think that, a lot of people like him probably felt very resentful that they couldn't just practice what they wanted to practice.
It's interesting to me that your country, India, and the country that you write about in your new book, Egypt, are both really torn apart now by religious violence.
That's absolutely true, yes. It's really very sad. And, one of the unfortunate things that you see is the ways in which there are such close parallelisms,
What are they?
Well, the parallelisms are not really in the religious aspect of it as, within the functioning of the state, so to speak, Because, the Egyptian state was in some ways quite like the Indian, There was sort of basic belief in a certain kind of secularism, most of all in sort of political processes and so on. And, from the Nasserite period onwards, there's been a considerable hostility between the Egyptian state and Islamic groups. And the same has been true in India, since the inception of the Indian state. There's been a certain sort of, many Hindu fundamentalist parties have been banned and so on. I think, unfortunately, we see ourselves in a situation now where states like the Indian state and the Egyptian state are really in a no-win situation. I mean, either they have to repress these movements, and that can only encourage their growth, or what do they do? It's a really unenviable situation.
You were recently back to India. Where did you stay when you returned?
In my hometown, Calcutta, which is where I live, really.
Was Calcutta under curfew when you were there?
No, it had just there had been curfew until a few days before I got back, but there wasn't when I was there.
How deeply affected by the religious upheaval in India was your family? How close had it hit?
Nothing had happened really very close by, nothing really close to our house, but. Most of all, what people are hit by is the kind of is the fear on the one hand that something really terrible is going to happen in the next day. That's one of the things that these situations build up. There's a sort of atmosphere of terror, of fear, and of the possibility of ever greater violence. So people are literally terrified. And I'm talking here about my parents, who are older people, and it's very frightening for them. The other thing is, of course, that they're just locked in the house. I mean, they can't step out of the house. They get about an hour every day to go and do their shopping. They're older people now, so it's it's harder for them to do that, and it is very frightening. At the same time, I'm very glad that they had the curfew, because in fact, what happened in Calcutta was that there was some trouble initially after the mosque was demolished in Ayodhya, and then. The government sort of had this curfew, and then they lifted the curfew for a day, and that was when a really sort of severe set of disturbances broke out. So, and then they had the curfew again. So, it really was a very tense situation.
A lot of the tension in India now is friction between Hindu fundamentalists who would like to see the state of India become a religious state,
yes,
and those who would like to see it remain a secular state.
Yes.
The term Hindu fundamentalist was a new concept to me. I was wondering if you think of that as a new phenomenon or not.
It is substantially a new phenomenon in the sense that, in the sense of it having the kind of widespread popular appeal that it does appear to have now. But, Hindu fundamentalism is really a contradiction in terms in many ways. I mean, Hinduism doesn't really have one book. It has this incredible multiplicity of traditions. It has, really sharp internal differences between castes and so on. But there's been a movement since the late 19th century to, ironically, to reform Hinduism as such. And, a lot of these have taken their clues, taken as their models Christianity and Islam even. There's a sort of emphasis on congregationalism. You know, now Hinduism is not, is really not a sort of congregationalist religion as such, but here there's a sort of tremendous emphasis upon congregationalism, upon a large groups of people getting together to pray together and so on. There's that for one. Then there's a sort of tremendous emphasis on conversion. Now, Hinduism, as most people know it, is not a religion that you can really be converted to as such. I mean, it's never been a sort of proselytizing religion. Even images of individual gods, you know, you see them change, and you see them sort of turning from being benevolent household gods into becoming these armed figures, you know, bearing, arms which have blood dripping off them and so on. The imagery is really terrifying.
My guest is Amitav Ghosh. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Amitav Ghosh, author of the new book, In an Antique Land. Muslim mosques and Muslim people have been under attack in parts of India. Did you grow up with Muslim friends? Mm. And I'm wondering if you've kept up with what it's been like for them recently.
You know, I think it's been really very, I mean, a lot of my friends, I've always had many Muslim friends. And, you know, when I grew up, there was really never a sense of a kind of distinction ever. And I'm happy to say that, you know, there still isn't for me. You know, it was very distressing to find out about the kinds of terror that they've been living under, for the last couple of months. A lot of Muslim friends I know now are really frightened of taking the train. They won't go anywhere on the train anymore. They'll just go along certain sorts of routes because, you know, there were a lot of killings on the trains and things. But I would like to say here, Laura, that, you know, to me, one of the most disturbing aspects of, what's happened in India over the last couple of months is that, it seems to be something that's happening at a very local level. But in fact, it's very integrally a part of global politics. And you see this all the time inside India, that a lot of the people who are attacking Muslims, a lot of the Hindu fundamentalist rhetoric, takes its cue from what it sees to be a sanctioned attitudes in the West now. You know, when we last spoke, we were talking about the Gulf War, and I was telling you then that, you know, one of the things that really worried me is the ways in which Islam is now increasingly demonized, in the West, in the U.S., I mean, where these incredibly negative images of Muslims are presented. And it's really frightening the ways in which, a lot of people within India and I'm sure in many other places take these images and appropriate them for their own use. Let me give you an example, which I heard very recently in Delhi. I heard about this young Muslim student while there was curfew in Old Delhi. He was walking some female relatives home, and he got caught out after the curfew hour. So he was taken to the police station there, and nothing was actually done to him. But he saw some other people there, also Muslims, being actually beaten, and some of the people who were doing the beating were berating them and saying, this is what is happening in Yugoslavia, this is what is happening to Muslims in this is what happened to Muslims during the Gulf War, this is what is happening in Somalia. So they were citing these as precedents for what they were doing. It's really impossible today to segregate the degrees to which the world is globalized. Incidents that happen across the world really set the pattern immediately in other places. And I really do think that, the world at large bears a large part of the responsibility for what's happening in India at the moment. I mean, the fact that so many Muslims have been attacked in Germany, things like that, you know.
You write in your book that as an Indian, you've become terrified of symbols. Can you explain that?
Yes. One of the sort of strange things about what's happened in India especially, I would say, is that so much of the sort of political struggle now takes place around symbols, you know? I mean, for example, the 16th century mosque, you know, which was a very small, very unimportant mosque. It was, or I should really call it a disputed structure, because, you know, it's that's the only sort of permissible way to refer to it anymore. But this small building, you know, it suddenly became a symbol for so many kinds of historical grievances, for so many sorts of political aspirations, and you know, it's you see the same phenomenon taking place in so many other places, that you know, the battles become centered around particular symbols, you know. Particular symbols begin to define divisions, begin to define boundaries and territories, and you know, the supremacy of one group or the lack of supremacy of another, or the and so on and so forth.
Do you have friends who have become fundamentalists, and who have very much surprised you in this change?
Yes, I have. I mean, they were not close friends, but there were certainly people I knew who I've grown up with, and who today are very, very articulate spokesmen of fundamentalism.
And of violence?
No. None of them. So none of them. I mean, they try and sort of divorce the questions of fundamentalism and violence. See, you know, what their position is, I mean, what they say is that this is just another step in nationalism. You know, they say that, you know, the nation state, as we know it in India, isn't working like it is. The fault is that, you know, we're not nationalist enough. We must be more nationalist. And the only way we can be more nationalist is by reasserting a sort of a Hindu identity or whatever. And, you know, they seem to believe this. They're extremely articulate, often in stating it. And I'm really talking about people, you know, who were once very far to the left, and who now are predictably, I suppose, very far to the right. You know, that this begs a million questions, you know, they never seem to take into account. I mean, the fact that, you know, what is this tradition you're talking about? You know, has it ever been a single tradition? Can you really hope to build a future upon, you know, reviving aspects of tradition? You know, these questions just go begging.
When you look at the fighting in your country,
yeah,
and you ask yourself, what is this really about?
Yeah.
What do you answer?
You know, it's very puzzling. I mean, it's really puzzling, because I'm increasingly, it's perfectly clear that it has nothing to do with you know, with religion. I mean, fundamentally, I don't think that the people who promote this thing has anything to do with religion. One part of it, I think, has to do with you know, a sense of historical grievance, you know, that sort of that a lot of people have, and that they're increasingly venting in one way or another. But you know, most of all, I think what's really happened is that, and I think this is true of several countries. You know, in the 50s and 60s, the non-aligned movement was led by Tito, Nehru, and Nasser, representing Yugoslavia, Egypt, and India. And it's a sad irony that, you know, it's in precisely in these places that you see these that you see the problems now representing themselves at their worst. And I think what has really happened is that, you know, countries like Egypt, India, and Yugoslavia promised something. They were built upon a certain dream. I think upon a very valuable kind of dream. You know, dreams of coexistence, dreams of equality, of a certain kind of of providing for people as best they could. But, you know, like so many sort of dreams of the 20th century, they just weren't able to deliver. And I think a large part of the problems that we see over here have to do with just failed expectations, mm-hmm. and frustration.
Amitav Ghosh is the author of In an Antique Land. Most of the plays, stories, and novels of Czech writer Ivan Klima were first published outside his own country, where they were banned until a few years ago. Klima was born in Prague, where he now lives, and during the Prague Spring, he edited the journal of the Czech Writers' Union. His new book is called Judge on Trial. Critic John Leonard has a review.
From Ivan Klima, who may be the best Czech writer who didn't run away to Paris and stay there even after the Velvet Revolution, We've come to expect fictions in which a sensitive intellectual tires of his marriage to a dumb and lumpy wife, takes up with a sexpot mistress, and feels at the end of the book even worse than he felt at the beginning, mostly because of Eastern European history. It's as if, ever since Orwell's 1984, a bed were the only trapdoor out of totalitarian dreariness. But we escape to find we've brought our gray and fearful selves right along with us. We still can't breathe. And to a degree, Klima's new novel fits his old pattern. Adam Kindel is a judge in Prague in 1972. His marriage to the scatterbrained Elena is loveless. He finds in the arms of Alexandra, who is both wanton and also chic, an ecstatic deliverance. But ambiguity and sadness are just waiting in ambush for him. This time, though, Klima has grander ambitions and delivers on them. It's not just that before Adam embarks on his affair, Elena has one of her own with a foolish and suicidal student, nor that Elena, God-haunted and hungry for community, is more appealing as a character than Adam. Adam, after all, is an apparatchik who's been trimming himself since a wartime childhood in a concentration camp until there's very little scruple left and not much sinew. It's that Klima wants us to understand, from the inside out, how a man of introspective intelligence could toil for so long in the party's vineyards and still sleep at night. In Darkness at Noon, Arthur Kessler imagined how an old Bolshevik could rationalize confessing at a show trial to ludicrous crimes against the revolution. In Judge on Trial, Klima imagines how a functionary might continue to serve the Byzantine whim of the communist state as a judge long after there was any justice. And so, in alternating flashback chapters, we get his dreadful war years, the young pioneer grammar school days when Adam also tried out with equal insincerity as a Christian, law school where he curried favor, his time served as a provincial judge, learning like a weather vane which way the wind blows, the flirtation in Prague with dissident intellectuals, who suffered more than he did after the Soviet repression of 1968, because he'd been visiting America during the important action, and finally, his last case, a brutal murder for which nevertheless he refuses to pronounce the death sentence, his last shred of honor. The jackals are gathering, and there is everywhere the smell of gas. It's the gas of the Nazi death house that took his best friend Ari. It's the gas he smells on the clothes of his wife when she comes home from her suicidal student. It's the gas the killer used on an old woman, which is why he's on trial in Adam's court. When we last see Adam at his cottage in the woods late at night, thinking perhaps of Seneca as the mist fills the valley like a sea to swim in, this mist too could be gas. Or something else under the moon. Just maybe. And it's a measure of Klima's achievement, as well as a reminder of Dostoevsky's, that we want to believe such transcendence is possible. What's out there is the moral grandeur he was always too afraid before to seek. After such a novel, no more show trials should be necessary.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Judge on Trial by Ivan Klima. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a one-woman show about the tensions between African Americans and ultra-Orthodox Jews in Crown Heights, Brooklyn. Anna Deavere Smith will perform excerpts of Fires in the Mirror, which will be broadcast Wednesday evening on Public TV's American Playhouse. New York Times theater critic Frank Rich called her show the most compelling and sophisticated view of urban racial and class conflict that one could hope to encounter in a swift 90 minutes. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new video of Handel's Julius Caesar, directed by Peter Sellers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton has signed an executive order that strengthens economic sanctions on Serbia. The order freezes all Yugoslav assets in the United States and allows searches of any ship or vehicle believed to be in violation of UN trade sanctions. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
White House officials said today that the sanctions are still aimed at the civilian economy, but predicted that the increased pressure will have an effect on the political calculations of Serbian leaders. In a letter to Congress released today, the president outlined U.S. compliance with the international trade embargo. A senior administration official said today there is a lot of crosstalk going on in diplomatic circles as the population expects things to worsen quickly. White House Press Secretary Dede Meyer says the president continues to consult with U.S. allies about additional options to end the violence in the former Yugoslavia. The president said recently he has not ruled out the possibility of airstrikes against Serbian military targets or lifting the arms embargo against Bosnian Muslims. But he has said repeatedly that the United States will not act alone. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
Preliminary results from Russia's nationwide referendum over the weekend indicate that President Yeltsin has gained a clear vote of confidence from his people. But his long-running struggle with the Russian parliament over who runs the country still seems far from over. Bridget Kendall of the BBC reports.
Some 62% of Russia's voters took part in Sunday's referendum, a respectable turnout that shows whatever their difficulties, Russians are far from being apathetic about the politicians who lead them. Of unofficial results received so far, it looks as though urban voters backed the president in large numbers, and in rural areas the vote was split. But overall, he can count on a comfortable majority in favor of his presidency. Already a moral victory, and one his supporters hope will dissuade the Congress from having another go at impeaching him. A more surprising result that has astonished his supporters and confounded his critics is the narrow majority he looks like winning in support of his economic policies. This is where Mr. Yeltsin's opponents hope to score. They're clearly disappointed. The Speaker of the Parliament, Ruslan Hasbulatov, has wasted no time in angrily dismissing the referendum.
Bridget Kendall reporting from Moscow. Officials at the White House term a vote of confidence for Russian President Boris Yeltsin a solid victory for democracy, after voters in Russia endorsed both Yeltsin's leadership and his moves to a free market economy. His supporters said that he had been given a mandate for change. Earlier, Secretary of State Warren Christopher had said that the Clinton administration would consider it a vote of confidence if Yeltsin received more than 50% of the vote. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 15 points to close at 3,398.37 on volume of 278 million shares. This is NPR News. According to a new survey by the Associated Press, nearly half of those contacted say that President Clinton has broken too many promises. However, just about the same number of people consider Mr. Clinton to be a strong leader. The poll also found that people who voted for the president are less likely than others to fault Mr. Clinton for breaking promises, while nearly a fourth are taking a wait-and-see attitude. The president got stronger support from women than men, according to the survey, and a majority of those contacted say the president has set the right tone for his administration. The president of Italy has named a new prime minister to head a new government. The former prime minister resigned after a referendum in which 80% of the nation's voters cast their ballots to radically change their political system. Francis Kennedy reports from Rome.
New prime minister is 72-year-old Carlo Azeglio Ciampi, governor of the Italian Central Bank. The appointment of a technocrat is a bid to ensure that party squabbling does not delay urgently needed electoral reform. There were hopes of bringing other parties in to strengthen the coalition, but for now only the small Republican Party looks likely to join. The former communists are unlikely to support a man expected to make tough economic decisions. Mr. Ciampi has already shown his independence by saying he will not hold long consultations with the parties before naming his ministers. While the financial market soared on news of his appointment, how successful he is in managing an Italian government will depend to a large extent on his choice of ministers. For National Public Radio, I'm Frances Kennedy in Rome.
Police in Colombia say that flooding has killed at least 17 people, with more than 40 others reported missing. The high waters touched off by heavy rainfall occurred during the night, carrying dozens of sleeping people from their homes. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. This Wednesday on public television, you can see Fires in the Mirror, a one-woman show which was one of the hottest tickets in New York last year. New York Times theater critic Frank Rich called it a compelling and sophisticated view of urban, racial, and class conflict. Fires in the Mirror was conceived by actress Anna Deavere Smith. The play is about the tensions between blacks and Jews in the Brooklyn neighborhood of Crown Heights. It's set in the summer of 1991, after a Hasidic Jew in Crown Heights killed a 7-year-old African-American boy in an auto accident, and in retaliation, a group of blacks stabbed to death a visiting Hasidic scholar. Smith tells the story from the points of view of over 20 different characters. She's African-American, but she plays the parts of blacks and Jews, women and men. All the characters Smith does are real people. Her monologues are adapted from her interviews with the actual people. She's working on a similar show about Los Angeles after the Rodney King beating. Last summer, I spoke with Smith about Fires in the Mirror. It was part of a special Fresh Air broadcast live from the Museum of Radio and Television in New York. We were joined by a studio audience. Anna Deavere Smith told me she was struck by the depth of difference between Jews and blacks in Crown Heights.
I've never been in a community where difference is as obvious and as physical and as material. That is to say that the Jewish people look like Lubavitch.
Yeah, these are the ultra-Orthodox Jews.
They're the ultra, one sect of ultra-Orthodox Jews. And the African-Americans there and Caribbean-Americans, you know, obviously identifiable because of the color of their skin, but it's also a community where you can hear Caribbean rhythms, and I was saying that people all wore their roots on their heads. The Hasidim men had yarmulkes, the women had wigs, or the men had fedoras, and in the African and Caribbean American community, you saw dreadlocks, various African head dressings, women with shells in their heads, and I was really stimulated by those obvious differences. I think it takes a lot of guts to wear your roots on your head.
You're going to do a couple of characters for us now. Is there anything else we should know before we hear you do them?
I don't think so. Maybe I'll just say their names and do them, and we could talk a little bit
more.
Great,
yeah.
Do you want me to do them both back to back,
Terry? Yeah, yeah.
Okay, the first one is a young man. I'm doing, by the way, characters that I haven't done on the air very much, and they happen to be both young men. I think Henry, the first one, is in his early 20s. Henry Rice. I title every selection that I do because I think people speak in poetry, so that these monologues are small poems. I call this one Certain Words. He knew how to use certain words. How to Use Certain Words is the title. And Henry is now working for the National Conference of Christians and Jews. Okay. I knew I was going to have to be elusive, so I went back home and I got my bicycle. And I weaved around trouble. When things broke out, I moved forward. When things calmed down, when things broke out, I moved back. When things calmed down, I moved forward. And I was standing around talking to a group of little kids about voting, the power of the vote. And Richard Green came by, and he said, and I said, get away from me, you Uncle Tom. No, I said, go on, get back in your Mercedes-Benz. No, I said that to Clarence Norman. No, I said it to them both. And I was tearing them apart. But Richard Green was very persistent. He said, Mr. Rice, I like the way you speak. He said, I need your help. And, oh! And here in the show, Henry drops his food on him. He says, oh! It didn't get on me. Okay. And But he said, I'm a community activist. I need your help. I didn't pay him no mind. But the next day was the day on Albany Avenue when the cops was out there chasing into the black crowd, not chasing into the Jewish crowd, and beating up black kids. And Richard Green came by in a yellow New York transportation van with the yellow lights flashing and a megaphone on the roof, the whole works. And he started calling out my name in the street, you know, Henry Rice. And at first I tried to ignore it, you know, but he kept on doing it. So I went over to the van and he said, Henry, I need you in this van. He said, come on, ride around with me tonight. Help me get some kids off the street tonight. So I said, okay. He said, the blood of the black man is on your hands tonight. I said, okay. So I get in the van, we're riding around. And I'm talking to the people on the loudspeaker, you know, mothers, please get your children off the street. You know, young people, please go back home. And I began feeling like I had to be there, you know, like the blood of the black man was on my hands tonight. And here he takes another bite of his hamburger. Richard Green sure know how to use certain words. Anyway, we get to Albany Avenue, and the cops was chasing these kids up the street. So I jump out the van with the portable megaphone. You know, I'm going like, don't run, and the cops won't hit you. You know, don't run, and the cops won't chase you. Next thing I know, cop comes along, hits me over the head with a stick, and handcuffs me. It takes a megaphone out of my hand. And I'm like, you know, I'm doing a community service for the mayor's office. They don't want to hear it. Matter of fact, they still have that megaphone to this day. So then I was like, Richard Green, would you come and get me out of this police car, please? So Richard Green came by, black captain came by, said, let him go, they let me go. Back in the van, another brother on the loudspeaker saying, nonviolence, peace. They started throwing rocks and bottles at the van. One young brother was so upset, he came over to the van with a 9mm fully loaded, said, get the hell out of this neighborhood. I told Richard Green, take me on home. Next day, more fires, lootings, and the perception that black youths was going crazy in Crown Heights. Like, they was angry for no reason. So that's Henry Rice. And
you can do one of the Hasidic Jewish characters.
Yes, and this is also a young man, 17 years old, Reuven Ostroff, who works as an assistant chaplain in downstate Kings County Hospital, and I call this piece Pogroms. I work as assistant chaplain at downstate Kings County Hospital, and they asked me if Yonkel Rosenbaum had an autopsy, because in the Jewish religion, you're not allowed to have an autopsy, and I found out that he did. And I saw a Jewish man, a Russian man, sitting in a room down by the morgue, and he told me that his mother had committed suicide because she was terrified. And we were sitting in a room down by the morgue trying to get his mother not to have an autopsy. And he told me that his mother had come from Russia because of the hardships there, and that when this thing happened in Crown Heights, it was just too painful. And he said, it's like everywhere you go, there's Jew haters. He said, it's like you're trapped. And he said he woke up in the morning because the doorbell rang, and he went into his mother's room, and the window was open, which he thought was strange because she was afraid of the cold even in the summertime. And he said he looked out the window, and there was blood all over the pavements because she had landed headfirst on the concrete side of the apartment building. And the next day, we knew it was really getting serious because Reverend Al Sharpton came down, Sonny Carson came down, start making pogroms.
My guest is Anna Deavere Smith. Her show, Fires in the Mirror, will be broadcast Wednesday evening on public TV. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Anna Deavere Smith is my guest. Now, you've all the characters you do in the show, you interview people, you transcribe what they tell you, and obviously you edit it, because as spoken as your stuff is, I know this from like transcribing interviews myself, that people speak really incoherently. And what you're doing is coherent. So you must really edit it a lot.
No, I try not to, actually. I just try to find a section in the whole interview that will stand on its own. Because once I begin to cut and paste, it takes me away from the through line of their thought, which is what I'm trying to discover by, you know, sort of externally repeating what they've said. And I try to just find a section that I can take out just like it is. Sometimes I can't, because the other thing that I try to do when using, in this case, you know, 29 different selections, is to have a narrative to tell a story. So each character has to push the story forward.
Part of what you're getting at is the way, the style of someone's speech, what that has to say about them.
It says everything as far as I'm concerned.
Can I ask you to do just a little bit of, there's a female rapper
right.
that you do in the show, and you really get into her sound, which is everything
right.
in rap.
Right.
And rap is just sound sure. language. So do a little bit of that
great.
For us and tell us how
okay.
you developed it.
And we call this piece Rhythm and Poetry. I'll just do a segment, a little segment into, I'm going into it. So my friends say, well, now, Mo, you know, Miss Mo, since you're so tough and so bad, how come you won't say nothing about Two Live Crew? When I talk about rap, I talk about people demeaning rap. I don't even mention them because they do not understand the fundamentals of rap. I mean, rap is basically broken down, is rhythm and poetry, you know. I mean, you know, poetry is expression. You can express anything through poetry. Poetry is intelligence. But if you ain't got a complex rhyme, I'm going to the store. What rhymes with store? More sore for more boy. I'm going to the store. I hope I don't get bored. What you saying, man? Who cares? No, you have to be deaf. D-E-F. Yeah, I guess I have to think of something for you, Terry, that's not slang. Deaf is dope. Dope is live. When you say something's dope, you mean it's the epitome of the experience. And we have to be deaf right now by our very presence, because we have to make people happy, because we are living in a society where people are not happy with their everyday lives.
That's great. Now, let's get back to the theme of your show, which is ethnic identity and ethnic differences. Why is that an important issue for you? Did you go through something in your life that made that really resonate?
Well, that's I suppose a long and complicated question. Race is my work. It has become my work. I don't think I necessarily set out to have it be my work. Although, as when I was in high school, I knew that I wanted to do something that had to do with people talking to one another, because I grew up in the, you know, during the civil rights movement. I didn't know what that was. I thought I wanted to be a linguist, and then I found out what linguistics was, and I didn't want to be a linguist. I just knew that I wanted to speak in multiple tongues, and I've eventually left the study of foreign languages, which is what I set out in order to do that. I thought maybe I would be a translator at the UN or something like that, and I find that in English we're ultimately speaking so many different languages that I have quite enough work to do right here.
Right. I've been reading a little bit about you, and I know that at some point, I think your family moved into a predominantly white neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
This was probably when you were in junior high or something.
Actually, high school, yeah.
That's
actually
a pretty self-conscious period of somebody's life.
Mm-hmm.
Did that create any kind of identity crises within you?
I think more shocking was really when I went to an integrated junior high school before we actually moved.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I don't know if it'd be as shocking now, but when I was growing up, my mother, for example, tells a story of taking me to stores, and the people, you know, African Americans couldn't try on the clothes. And the ladies would say things to her like, oh, well, she looks clean. Let's sneak her in. Let me try on the clothes. And my brother, my younger brother, has blonde hair and blue eyes. And I have heard several stories of people coming up to my mother and saying, my God, where did you get that pretty little boy? And at first I thought, well, it's all about Diva being so pretty, and now, you know, I'm just holding on to the back of her dress, nobody cares about me. But no, what's interesting about that story, I realize now, is the use of the word get. You know, and I don't know what was going on. And we had a good friend across the street, a very light-skinned boy, whose mother gave him a spanking in a department store. And all of these white women came over and chastised her, because I guess they assumed that she was the maid and that this child wasn't her child. So, I mean, that's like what I grew up in my life's work. my life's work as a human being has been to resolve much of that and to find a way of living in a society which has different kinds of people.
I'm wondering if being light-skinned African-American has put you kind of in the middle in a way.
Not ultimately. I mean, ultimately, ultimately, you know, I'm African-American.
Oh, no, I realize that.
No, but I mean, ultimately, I think I'm, I don't think, I shouldn't say that so quickly, but ultimately, I think still some of the same kinds of things play out for me that do for other darker-skinned African-Americans. There is a kind of way that aesthetically I am in the middle, so that when I got out of acting school, the first agent that I ever went to said to me, well, I couldn't possibly send you out because I don't want to offend my clients. They wouldn't know what to do with you. What are you? What would you go as?
Wow.
And one agent here in New York who said, I think you should try to pass as Spanish.
Love stories like that. Oh, well.
Aren't they good? Yeah. I haven't had a chance to tell any of those. Thanks, Terry.
Anna Deavere Smith's Fires in the Mirror will be broadcast Wednesday evening on Public TV's American Playhouse. Her new show about Los Angeles after the Rodney King beating is scheduled to premiere in June at the Mark Taper Forum in Los Angeles. Our interview with Smith was recorded last summer at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York. This is Fresh Air. Most of the votes are in on yesterday's referendum in Russia, and it looks like a victory for Boris Yeltsin. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. NPR's Anne Garrels is in Moscow. She will explain, analyze the Boris Yeltsin victory in Russia. New sanctions against Serbia and Montenegro go into effect because the Bosnian Serbs refused to make a deal on the Van Zoen peace plan. I'll talk with Radovan Karadzic, the leader of the Bosnian Serbs. He says the Serbs want peace, don't want any more territory, will in fact give some territory back. They just want a map that links up Serb territory in Serbia, Bosnia, and Croatia. Also, our colleague Linda Wertheimer on President Clinton's first 100 days. She begins a week of reporting from Route 50 crossing the country.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Peter Sellers is the stage director whose controversial Mozart opera productions have appeared on public television. He also produced a video version of one of his other major stage successes, Handel's Julius Caesar, but PBS decided not to telecast it. It has, however, been released on VHS and Laserdisc. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz is a big Peter Sellers fan. Here's his review.
Peter Sellers' production of Handel's Julius Caesar may be the best thing he's ever done. It's one of Handel's greatest works, an endless flow of melody, comedy, heroic spectacle, and poignant interior drama. Sellers updates the story of Julius Caesar's encounter with the young Cleopatra, the assassination of Pompey, and Roman imperialism in the Middle East. His contemporary images are sometimes savagely satirical. Caesar is Reaganized. Cleopatra is a bathing beauty whose brains aren't all in her bikini. Pompey's young son, Sesto, is a kind of preppy Hamlet who turns radical revolutionary when he has to avenge his father's death. These work because the ironies in the opera itself seem very modern. Handel's awareness of the tragic cost of political life looms behind all the jokes. Sellers assembled one of the finest casts I've ever seen in an opera production, and with Craig Smith's impassioned and dramatically paced conducting, the 5 hours fly by. PBS made a big mistake not to air it on television. That was soprano Susan Larson as Cleopatra. Wearing a low-cut gold lamé gown, she seduces Caesar by descending from the rafters like a Ziegfeld girl sitting on the hook of a giant building crane. Who is Caesar not to be ravished by her? Caesar is magnificently sung and powerfully acted by the extraordinary countertenor Geoffrey Gall. Early music star Drew Minter gives the most vivid performance of his career as the magenta-haired, sexually ambivalent punk rocker Ptolemy. And mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt, in the male role of Sesto, is hair-raising in his ferocious determination to destroy his father's killers. Here she is in one of the great moments of 18th century opera. It's a duet with contralto Mary Westbrook Gia, who plays the matronly but equally vengeful Cornelia, Pompey's widow and Sesto's mother. They're being dragged off as political prisoners. Their achingly beautiful goodbyes blend in mutual lament. This scene is magnificent. Sellers has the two singers weave in and around each other in a haunting choreography of pain. His camera work, however, doesn't always show off his staging to best advantage. His relentless close-ups and cross-cutting never establish the location of a scene, and the camera doesn't always flow with the music. Still, the more you watch, the more what you see makes sense on its own terms. At the end, when Caesar and Cleopatra are giving their first public press conference together, TV seems the most appropriate medium. And when all the characters, including the ones who've been killed, reemerge to join in the final chorus of joy, the effect may be even more shattering on a TV screen than it was in the theater.
Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviewed the Peter Sellers, Craig Smith production of Handel's Julius Caesar. It's been issued on VHS and Laserdisc by London. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, George Shultz looks back on his years as Secretary of State. Also, we discuss Bosnia with Arye Nair, Executive Director of Human Rights Watch. Nair and his colleagues have just returned from Bosnia and have completed Volume 2 of a report on war crimes there. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.